You're listening to the UFO Talker Podcast. Come with us as we explore UFOs from the past and the present. With insightful discussions, interviews, and reviews, we will add our voice to the mysteries that have been seen in our skies and oceans for all of human history. Now, here's our host, Michael Ryan.
Welcome, everybody, to the podcast. This is Season 2, Episode 35, coming to you from Studio 7H here in Ontario, Canada. On today's episode, I have an interview with Jan Aldridge, who is going to talk about many things, but the main focus will be Lieutenant Colonel Wayne Matson, who is not a really well-known name in ufology, but he actually was one of the first that knew the most about UFOs. And then, as you probably have guessed already, Christine is not with us today. First, I want to give a shout-out to Dave Nelson, who is at Boom 99.7 in Ottawa. And a couple of weeks ago, after we had our Parliament Hill incident show, he gave us a shout-out, and he talked about our show a bit. So I'm returning the favor today. And Dave also has a TikTok channel where he discusses UFOs and paranormal events. And I will put a link to Dave's TikTok in my show notes. So thank you very much, Dave Nelson, at Boom 99.7 in Ottawa, Ontario. I want to read out a couple of festivals, the first being the Spruce Pines Alien Festival in North Carolina. And that takes place on June 8th, and they have a lot of events planned there. And again, I'll put a link to their festival in the show notes. But the speakers are Mike Barra, Dr. Brooks Agnew, Christian McLeod, Robin Hayes, and Ash Hamilton. And next we have the Shag Harbor UFO Expo, which takes place September 27th through 29th in Yarmouth, Nova Scotia. And that is a beautiful part of Canada. And their speakers include Bryce Sable, Chris Rutkowski, Jennifer Stein, Preston Dennett, who we've interviewed a couple of times on the podcast, and Chris Stiles. So that sounds like an excellent lineup. And I'll also put a link to that festival in my show notes as well. And here's some news I got from the Black Vault website. And this is from April 24th, and John Greenwald Jr., had put on there AARO, which is the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office, provided their final report on the Eglin UAP incident. And that incident was a U.S. military pilot seeing a UFO near Eglin Air Force Base in Florida. So AARO has said they have gone over this sighting thoroughly and collected a lot of data in the process. And in the end, they felt very confident that it was most likely a commercial balloon that the pilot had witnessed. Now, I can't comment on this one specifically, but I have seen a few in the last couple of years where they have had military jets flying past some of these objects that have been called UFOs. And I don't know, when I look at them, they definitely could be balloons. Some of them, to me, look, you know, obviously like balloons. But I will put a link to that report in the show notes so you can take a further look at it. And my shout out today, where we have listeners, and it definitely qualifies as a small town, and it is Boron, California, which is a desert town in Kern County. And it has a population of 2,086 people. So yes, it is pretty small. And as always, I have looked at videos online. One of the videos is by a woman whose channel is called Wonder Hussy. And she goes all around the California desert showing towns and cities and places of interest. And I've actually seen her show before. She's normally pretty interesting. And her video on Boron was interesting as well. So from what I can see, Boron looks like your typical small desert town. You know, they always fascinate me. And of course, boron is a little bit rough around the edges. Some parts of it has seen better days, but there is something quaint about desert towns. They're just, I find them romantic, you know. So much history has gone on there, and it's on the edge of civilization, and I find the deserts particularly interesting for some reason. A lot of people don't like them for whatever reason, but I think there are really beautiful places. And Boron, California is actually the site of one of the largest open pit mines in the world. And it is, of course, named after the substance they found there a long time ago, which is boron. And the little town, it actually has several museums, which is kind of interesting for a place this small, but it has the 20 Mule Team Museum. And I learned something when I watched the video. Whenever they say this 20 Mule Team, which is kind of famous in history, it's actually only 18 mules and 2 horses. But for whatever reason, they always called it the 20 Mule Team. I think borax, that was their claim to fame for their washing detergent. And they also have a small aerospace museum there, which is very interesting. And many movies have been shot in Boron. So parts of Aaron Brockovich with Julia Roberts was shot in Boron. And a 1964 film, The Carpetbaggers, which starred George Peppard, Alan Ladd, and Carol Baker, was shot there. And that movie actually had, the music was composed by Elmer Bernstein, which is one of the better film composers. And there was a TV show there called Death Valley Days, was shot there on and off through its run. And much to my surprise, there actually is a bakery there. There's actually a couple of places that have baked goods there, which really shocked me. They actually have a Cinnabon. I mean, that is very odd, isn't it? In a town that small. But I won't be going to the Cinnabon. I will be going to B-Town Donuts. And, you know, it just looks like one of those old-fashioned places which has the person that's been making donuts for all their life, and, you know, they're going to be really, really good. Now, the only thing is, if you go to B-Town Donuts, make sure to go there early because they're only open from 5 a.m. till 10 a.m. in the morning. That's it. So if you want your donut fix in Boron, California, you got to wake up early and get there quick. And there are also a few restaurants in Boron, California, which also surprised me. And obviously the best ones, I'm going to name two of them, are Domingo's Mexican Restaurant, which has a lot of great reviews, very good Mexican food. And also The Barrel, which is kind of a larger building that is in the shape of a barrel, believe it or not. And that looks very interesting, and it kind of looks like more like fast food, but it's been there, I believe, over 25 years, so the food must be good. But that's our shout-out to Boron, California. And even though it's small, it does look like an interesting place to stop at. And if you like the desert, I would highly recommend it for sure. And as always, if you're from Boron, California, we would really like to hear from you and what you think of Boron, California. And no matter where you're from around the world, and there are 20 different countries that listen to UFO Talker, we would love to hear from you. So send us an email at ufotalker@bell.net. And we will be right back after this message.
The date was December 30th, 1966. It was a clear, moonlit night as Canadian Pacific Flight 421 flew at 31,000 feet through the inky darkness just off the Peruvian coast. The DC-8 was on its way to Mexico City. Captain Robert Milbank had put the aircraft on autopilot. Co-pilot J.D. Dahl looked down at his watch. It was 3 a.m. Most of the passengers were asleep. It was very quiet on the aircraft. He was thinking about the great time he and his wife had at their home in White Rock, British Columbia, last New Year's Eve. Captain Milbank, who had been looking at something off the left side, asked Dahl to take a look at this. The pilot and co-pilot could see two extremely bright white lights. Within a minute, the two white lights seemed to be moving towards their aircraft. Finally, the object placed itself off their left wing and paced their DC-8. Co-pilot J.D. Dahl thought the object was roughly the same size as their DC-8 and about 500 feet away. They could see a row of dimmer, yellow-white lights between the two white lights. They called for other crew members to take a look. Some thought they could make out the shape of a craft, like a saucer shape. After 7 minutes, the lights moved towards the tail of the DC-8, and finally the object took off at tremendous speed. When asked about the sighting later, Captain Robert Milbank said, "I must say that in my 26 years of flying, including wartime, I have never seen anything like this before, and I'm convinced that UFOs are not a dream in somebody's head." What did the crew of Flight 421 see in the early morning hours of December 30th, 1966? In his final report, co-pilot J.D. Dahl said, "I was a non-believer before, but I was satisfied that we'd been intercepted by something not of this earth, and I've been in the interception business for 4 years."
My next guest is Jan Aldridge. Jan has been a UFO researcher, historian, archivist for over 60 years. He joined NICAP in 1958. Jan has also traveled thousands of miles to libraries, archives, colleges, and universities across the United States and Canada researching UFOs. Jan is truly a legendary figure in ufology, and I'm honored to have him back on the show again today. Jan, welcome back to the podcast.
Well, thank you.
Today, we're going to talk about somebody that is very interesting, and I don't believe a lot is known about him, and it's Lieutenant Colonel Wayne Mattson. I'm just going to read a little bit of a bio here first before we get underway. When Wayne Mattson was 17, he joined the Army Air Force. In 1951, he joined the Naval Academy. He graduated from Annapolis in 1955 and then joined the Air Force. He then went to the Strategic Air Command from 1959 to 1962. After that, he went to the Air Force Institute of Technology at the University of Wyoming, where he got his degree in aeronautical engineering. From there, he went to Edwards Air Force Base, where he did research and testing of new aircraft, including the F-111. He was then ordered to Thailand during the Vietnam War, where he flew reconnaissance missions. After Vietnam, he was sent to Holloman Air Force Base to do aircraft and missile testing. After that, he went to Wright-Patterson as a test director for the air-to-ground missile program. In 1979, he retired from the Air Force and went to work for Hughes Aircraft. In 1989, he retired from Hughes Aircraft and moved to Alamogordo, New Mexico, where he volunteered at the Space Center Museum. In 1995, he wrote a book called We Develop Missiles, Not Air, which is the history of Holloman Air Force Base. And Jan and I aren't exactly sure, but he passed away sometime around 2021. He's a very interesting character. I think he would have made an excellent whistleblower. So, Jan, I have some questions for you about Lieutenant Colonel Wayne Mattson. And I guess my first question is, how did he first come to your attention? Like, when did you first learn of Lieutenant Colonel Wayne Mattson?
Tom Tulin, who was a document producer, and I used to go around the country finding interesting people in ufology to interview. Tom had interviewed Mattson a few years before I met him, but Tom had done about 200 interviews. I've done about 80 with him. People on the West Coast sometimes accompany Tom, like Brad Sparks interviewed Colonel Friend before he passed away. Lieutenant Olson, who was Ruppelt's number two guy in Project Blue Book during the 50s, we interviewed the CIA. Well, he was a lieutenant commander in the Navy when he was seconded to the CIA, and he was on the Robertson panel where they went ahead and evaluated UFOs, and he's the one that wrote the record of the Robertson panel. Interesting aside, in the military, we say the guy that writes the record of the meeting controls the meeting because he decides what goes in the record.
Yes. Whatever.
However, astronomer Thornton Page was one of the scientists on the Robertson panel, and he made extensive notes, and afterwards he gave them to Howard Menzel, the director of the Harvard Observatory, and Thornton Page's notes are in American Philosophical Library in Philadelphia. Most people don't know that. We have an alternate record of what happened at the Robertson panel. Tom and I, we wanted to interview Terry Clark at Alamogordo. You may have heard of this. It's called the. He wrote a magazine article called "The Day Came to Alamogordo." It was about the 1957 wave, and specifically one of the car stopping incidents about one of the technicians that worked at Holloman. We interviewed him, and then Tom took me over to meet Wayne Mattson, and we discussed UFOs, and he's very knowledgeable, and he had done for the, he had worked at the Air and Space Museum there. Now, the head of the museum was death on UFOs, so Wayne would have people come in, you know, missile trackers, pilots, people that worked at Holloman, and interview them, oral histories about what they had done. But he couldn't ask about UFOs. The boss said no. No talking about UFOs. So he would turn off the camera and then ask the guy about UFOs later. And a number of people at Holloman had interesting UFO experiences. I have a Holloman section on my website, so if you like to go there, I have some of the items that, you know, some of the sightings at Holloman there. So Wayne introduced us to some of the local people that had been involved in UFOs one way or another. We interviewed them. He gave me a history of Holloman, tests at Holloman, and things that he had researched. And I think later on he turned that into a book. It was very interesting because Tom had just completed his UFO analysis of the Minot UFO case in North Dakota, and he had got several people to work on the case with him. The head of the French UFO, official French UFO organization that works for the French Space Agency had looked at the radar in this case, and also a English radar expert had also looked at the case. So Tom had the photographs of the Minot case, and when we got to talking, Tom showed Mattson the photographs, and he immediately knew what was happening on the photographs.
Hmm.
He hadn't seen them before. He'd heard about Minot, but he hadn't seen it. And he looked at it, and that's because he had worked on radar, and he had a earlier sighting in 1959, which is listed on his report form for the, I think the main event that we're going to talk about today, in February 17th, 1969, at the Laos-Thailand border. So he did not at that time tell us about this case.
Hmm.
I went to the University of Wyoming, and Dr. Richard Haynes, people may know about NARCAP, it's an aviation safety organization. It looks at close approaches or near misses with UFOs. All his case files are at the University of Wyoming. So I started going through them, and here comes this 1969 case. And I looked, and it was a report form from Wayne Metz and several other documents further talking about the case. And he, I said, "Right, that guy never told us about this." And so he had written Dr. Haynes quite a bit of correspondence on this and other things, and also let Haynes know about some cases that he had got involved with. So this is very interesting. It's a very good report. It's substantial, and it involves radar.
And this happened while he was flying reconnaissance missions in Vietnam, I believe.
Yes, and this particular mission, he was on a this was a combat mission, so he had ordnance on his plane, even though it was a Cessna. The official designation is O2A. However, the commercial version is a Super Skymaster, and he was involved in night combat during this mission, and he was returning from a mission in Laos, and they had engaged the enemy there, and they were at the border with Thailand when they were informed by ground radar at U Ban Air Force Base in Thailand, which we had. It was a joint Thai-American base at the time. And our radar informed him that there was something up there with him, and he wanted to know what it was. He was turning towards U-Bahn. I guess he said he made a 180-degree turn after he crossed the border. And at about 60 degrees of elevation, I'm getting ahead of myself. Yeah, the radar wanted to know what's up there, and he said, "We've got you, your identification, friend or foe, but what's that other object, what's that other aircraft with you? Are you holding hands?" Well, holding hands means one aircraft is constantly broadcasting its location, or when inquired, it will broadcast its location. Since this was combat, the ground radar knew he was up there. So he figured the radar operator on the ground figured the other one, the other aircraft had turned off its identification, friend or foe. Wayne said, "We don't have anything up there with us." And then when making the turn towards the Air Force base, he saw this, what looked like two moons. One was at 60 degrees elevation. It was the same angular size as the moon, so it looked like a twin moon. It was like a sphere at first, they thought it was. So maybe it's a mirage of the moon. If it's a mirage, how come they're picking it up on radar? They decided to go ahead and take a look, and as they did, the UFO turned on its axis, turned into it now appeared to be a disc-shaped object. Let me say this. Matson was, at the time, he was kind of interested in UFOs. He had a previous UFO experience, like I said, in 1959 at SAC. So they were rather nonplussed by this, and radar operator was talking to him, and as they were trying to get a better look at it, it accelerated away and disappeared. Now the question is, do they report it? Well, he's got more than one pilot on the aircraft, and Matson knew how to fill out a service report, communications instructions for reporting vital intelligence. He had already shown a number of people when he had been in the Air Force how to fill his report out. But when it came to him having to report it, he was worried about himself and the other pilots on the aircraft that they would lose their flying status. because he had heard of other people losing their flying status for reporting something. So here you've got a dichotomy. The regulation says you will report all unknown objects and enemy aircraft and rockets and ships and all things like that. But then if you report a flying saucer or a UFO, you may lose your... it doesn't say that in the regulation, but just the policy at the time. This was about at the close of Blue Book. So the policy at the time was you just keep your mouth shut, because if you don't, you'll lose your flying status. They decided they wouldn't report it. Now, that doesn't mean that the ground radar operator didn't report it, but we can't find any evidence in Blue Book that it was reported. Now, if you go to Project1947.com, there's an article on there by Barry Greenwood about UFOs in Vietnam. So we found a number of UFO cases in Vietnam during Blue Book and after Blue Book.
And is this recently did you find these, or have they been there for a while?
They've been there. They've been up there for a couple of years. Also, the archives, you know, they'll be looking through, you know, combat reports and other things from the Vietnam War. And every once in a while, they'll find a UFO case, you know, not just by Air Force people, but Army and Navy. When they find something like that, they usually just put it in as a curiosity. But Greenwood was able to find a whole bunch of cases. And since he wrote that article about what we found, we found out that there were two projects in Vietnam. They were using radar, they're using television, they're using all kinds of sensors. Remember now, Arrows just told us that we're having problems with sensors. Sensors don't give us the information we want. Boulder Dash.
Yeah.
They had a procedure that they said, we're not accepting any cases that are less than 2 minutes long, and we want cases with sensor readings. And this was being done within the Far East Command. So these things weren't, except in a few cases, weren't reported to Blue Book. The Condon Committee didn't get to see these. One of the projects was called Have Fear, and another project was called Cocked Pistol, but we think that's an error. Cocked Pistol is a state of readiness. So we think, but there is another UFO project in Southeast Asia at the same time. There's 500 cases from, I think it's Have Fear. Only one was were they able to explain it. Except then the chief of staff of the Air Force mentioned this after the war was over. He said, we had a lot of trouble with UFOs in Vietnam. I mean, he came right out and said this at a press conference. These things are, Greenwood has found some, and we've also found things from Thailand and other areas in Southeast Asia at the same time.
You mentioned that Lieutenant Colonel Wayne Mattson, after he retired, he was volunteering at the Space Center Museum in Alamogordo, and that he had heard, you know, he would turn off the recording devices and ask all of his questions about UFOs to the people he met there. Is this what has happened to this oral information? Did he ever write it down, or is it?
No. The oral information. I think he knew Tony Long, another ufologist who kind of disappeared for a while. I think he may have some of this. The recorded information is at, I think it's at Holloman. I think it's at the center, let's put it that way. And that's official records. That's oral histories of people that were in the military at Holloman. But the UFO part was, you know, afterwards.
And what? Where is that kept? Like, is that recorded anywhere, or?
Let's put it this way. The official oral histories, I think, are at the museum. and the UFO stuff, he didn't give us, he gave us a little hints about that, but he didn't really discuss that much with us. After he turned off and did the official interview, he did talk to people there about what was going on at Holloman. So he had information. He also did newspaper searches around there, and I think I mentioned before, he found a report from the president of Air Land Company. Now, this is this is a company that has contracts with the Air Force and the Army. They track missiles and other aircraft. The president and one of his assistants were driving on a regular highway, and they had a UFO sighting. That's not in Blue Book. That's in the newspaper, and Wayne Matson had found that, and it was in the interior of the newspaper, not very prominent.
What year was that?
1953.
And does that company still do work for the Air Force, or just back then?
I'm not sure. I think like everything else, they've merged or been bought out or something like that. I would have to do some research on it. I don't know. On my website, a section on just Holloman Air Force Base items that I had found. And Robert Todd had got information from Holloman on a microfilm of tracking data. So that's also on my website. That's on as a separate article.
Now, there's a couple of stories here I want to try and confirm with you if you know about them. So I have read that Lieutenant Colonel Wayne Matson, he had investigated the story of a UFO landing at a gate at Holloman Air Force Base. And then because Holloman is so big, there's several gates, and this was one that was probably not the main one. Do you know much about that case?
No, he never discussed that with us. So I can't really comment on it because I don't really know much about it. I think he had a couple of sightings while he was in Alamogordo, but he thought they were just, aircraft at night. So he wasn't too impressed with them, but he did tell us that he personally had sightings down there.
And also, did he, I have read that he had a belief that, and this was years ago, he believed that the U.S. did have in its possession UFOs. Did you hear much about that?
No, he was violently against that. Let's put it this way. At the time I went down there, Tom wanted to talk to this other guy who had been around White Sands and Holloman since the 30s, and this guy's thing was that everything, all UFOs were just secret aircraft. So Wayne knew the guy, and I think that's the reason Tom wanted to talk to this guy. So Wayne called him up, and we went out and interviewed him, and I could tell all the time we were interviewing this, Wayne's blood was boiling. He didn't think much of this guy at all. But when we go out and interview people, we don't necessarily interview people that agree with us. Or we even interview people that we feel are hoaxers. It's just to get the record straight. And we interview people that are maybe considered low reliability. So at this time, at least, I can tell you that he did not have this idea. Wayne didn't have the idea that this was some kind of project that started in the 30s. Of course, you've got the whistleblower now, Grush, and he is pushing the Italian 1933 case of Mussolini UFO. Well, okay. The Italians that we deal with have pretty well decided that that's a hoax, and they've done extensive investigation on it. However, Grushes decided that it's real, and his buddy Alonzo told him it's 100% true. All I can say, you've got to look at all sides of UFO cases when you investigate them, and I don't think Grush is aware that this one has been investigated and found to be full of hoax documents with actual documents sprinkled into the information to make it look like it's real and official. However, it's pretty well considered a hoax by most of the Europeans. There's a few that push it, just like it's the old MJ-12 thing. Some in Europe call it the European Roswell.
There's another rumor that Lieutenant Colonel Wayne Mattson, when he worked at Wright-Patterson, he worked with a guy that apparently, as you've mentioned in the past, that they get a lot of material there that they investigate to see if it is, they've been told it's from an actual UFO, but he worked with a guy that apparently had material and said that he couldn't find it being replicated by any known material on Earth. Is that true? Did he mention anything about that?
No, he did not. He did not. I'd like to say something about that, though. Wright-Patterson, they do have one of the boxes in Blue Book. They have all this material that people have turned in as being parts of UFOs. And some of it's pretty fanciful.
Why do you think that the stories that Lieutenant Colonel Wayne Mattson talked about and knew about, why do you think that he's not as popular as a lot of other people in ufology? Like, you don't hear his name coming up as often as other people.
Yeah, I think he kind of kept a low profile because he was working at the museum there. So I don't think he kept a low profile. I mean, he didn't even tell Tom and I about his sighting in Thailand. He told Dr. Richard Haynes because he sent him a report form, which Haynes's report forms are much superior to the official report forms. Especially when aircraft are involved, sightings from aircraft. And so Haynes, his UFO report forms are much better than the official ones. I think he was known in New Mexico, but not really well known. I mean, Terry Clark knew him and some other people around that area knew him. And he had given several talks in that area, so he had talked about this thing in Thailand. So, but he was kind of close to the chest type of thing as far as national exposure. And he never said anything to NICAP. That would have been a fascinating report to have in the 60s or 70s. And I'm sure Keo would have, banged on that for quite a while.
Yes, and then because he also worked for Hughes Aircraft, and so he would have had a lot of knowledge about a lot of different systems.
Right. Yeah, it's just like the aircraft, the radar photographs. I mean, he was telling us what, just by looking at him, what was going on the photographs, so. I try to remind people, but it's like especially with the more skeptical people. And of course, we can't, we can't get into aero unless we say we are a whistleblower. But aero keeps saying, "Oh, we don't have anything. We don't have anything. No physical evidence. Radar photographs are physical evidence."
Yes,
and you can take them out of the file and look at them at any time. So that gets rid of that re- reproducibility thing, too. So this is an actual case with physical evidence. And I keep pushing that. And there's other cases like that. There's a lot of radar cases in the file. On the Robertson panel, Luis Alvarez, you know, a Nobel Prize caliber radar expert, he was unimpressed by the radar cases that he was shown at the Robertson panel, because he said, I don't care what a radar operator, what his impression of what is going on. I want facts. I want qualitative and quantitative data, not what some radar operator said that he thought was happening. And in 52, there weren't very many radar photographs. There were some, let's put it this way, that we could get at. But everybody talks about Washington, D.C. That part of Blue Book is so confusing, Brad Sparks, that I just threw up my hands when I started going through the documents there. There's things that are missing, lots of stuff that's missing. Fournet did write, Major Fournet, who was the Pentagon UFO monitor, he did write his experiences of looking at the radar. There's a Navy radar expert at the Pentagon in Air Force Intelligence, and he went into the National Airport with Fournet, and he jumped on a radar and immediately started tracking them. There's nothing, there's no evaluation from him in the Blue Book files. I see some material from St. Louis that has been sent to the Air Force Historical Records Agency at Maxwell Air Force Base, and I'm trying to get it. It's about stuff from Andrews Air Force Base, which is across the city from Washington Nationals. I'd like to see that. Ruppelt, he was cut out of the investigations. Boiling Air Force Base, Director of Intelligence, Captain Barkoff, he was assigned to look at that, look at the Washington Nationals. He produced an interim report, which the OSI also used. Part of that is on my website. There are other reports that Barkoff completed. We don't know if they're UFO or not, but I think they are. Every intelligence report has a serial number. So his interim report is there. The next one you'd think would be the final report, but that report, that serial number is missing from the Blue Book files or anywhere else we can find. So there's a lot to find. And if you read the Arrow report, I don't think these guys are going to find it. I'm almost giving up on their, they have no idea how this historical pre-Tic Tac cases look like. In fact, they deny there's any cases from the close of Blue Book in 1969 to the Tic Tac. That's hogwash. Complete and utter hogwash. We have a lot of the Freedom of Information Act items from the 70s, 80s, 90s.
Do you think with Arrow, do you think that that's really more of a public relations campaign? Because it's, to me, it doesn't seem like they really want to get to the bottom of anything. It seems like, you know, maybe the face of a PR campaign on UFOs.
Well, it's seven years, and they've reorganized the investigation several times. I thought that ODNI was, you know, the lead organization on this, but they didn't sign off on the Arrow report. Maybe they were embarrassed to. It's time for the adults in the room to take over.
Yeah, because they're not really, you know, a lot of these guys, I'm not sure how much they know about the history of UFOs or, you know, the cases that are out there that are just really incredible.
Yeah, and okay, I can't send everybody a copy of UFOs in Government, but I've sent, not just me, but other people have also sent that to agencies and legislators and, you know, heads of agencies, it hasn't made any effect. Don't even get an acknowledgement. And UFOs in Government, the organization that recommends books for colleges, what they should have in their libraries, gave UFOs in Government a stellar review. It says it was written by advocates, but it said it doesn't have any of the silliness of the whole thing. And so we're at universities all over the country and overseas. Our book is, and we've given a number of these, I'd say maybe 20, 25 to various agencies and senators and congressmen. Seems to have, it just rolls off their back. Mm. Let me say something about congressional hearings, because everybody says, oh, these people got up at congressional hearings and they swore that they did. Listen, this isn't the first time that UFOs have been in the, and people may remember the aliens and how they were supposedly cloning human beings. Congress was very upset about that, and they had those people in, and of course they were lying to Congress. Nothing happened to them. Not a thing.
What do you think the, recently there's this Rear Admiral from the U.S. that has come out that has talked about USOs or submerged objects. What do you think about what he's saying now?
Well, he is one person that did look at history. And so there used to be a site called Water UFOs on the Internet. That's where he's getting most of his material. So it's not as if he has specific knowledge. At least if he does, he's not talking about it. He's using this this website that was on there. Very good website. There's also a book about UFOs associated with water. And I have also put on a number of, let's put it this way, not just Navy, but official seagoing cases. I call it the NavCat. That's on my website also. It hasn't been updated lately. I have about 500 more that need to go into this. I do not guarantee all these cases, but a lot of them are from official documents, and it's the U.S. seagoing, Coast Guard, and other organizations. The Army has a huge floating logistics boats, all ships and boats all over the place, so they report these things too.
How do you think Lieutenant Colonel Wayne Mattson, how do you think his opinions on UFOs changed over the years, like from when he first was younger till the later parts of his life?
I think he was very critical and skeptical in the early his early stuff, his early interest in UFOs. I think that case in that radar case that's listed separately on there, in 1959 radar case, he also did not discuss that with us. It was only on Haynes's form. I would love to hear more about that. But when I talked to him, he was very skeptical. And this fellow that is, like I said, in New Mexico, who is always pushing, well, these are our things, and we started doing research in the 30s. Well, if we started doing research in the 30s, why didn't we use that stuff during the Second World War?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so that's, anyways, and that was one of his main arguments against this fellow who was an advocate of, you know, a top secret UFO program. So I really, I noticed as he's getting older, like the Holloman Air Force case you spoke of, like I said, I don't really know what his opinion of it was. But I do know that he was interested in a lot of things that were at the edge, Admiral Byrd, after the Second World War, Admiral Byrd took an expedition to Antarctica. And, of course, in UFO lore, he's fighting Germans that are in Antarctica. I don't put any credence in that story, but I think Wayne, he gave it a possibility. I did discuss that with him, and I said, I can't see it. I said, how could the Nazis resupply armed force in Antarctica? He said, oh, Central America, you know, they had a lot of Germans in Central America that were sympathetic to the cause. And I said, you're going to have to do better than that. But we argued on that a little. And he showed me some articles, and I kind of thought it was not by the cream of ufology, let's put it that way. I can't find anything that indicates that there was a big battle in Antarctica. If there was, there had to be casualties. Where's the casualty list?
That's an interesting case, because you think there had to be some reason to do what they did, because it was an unusual event to have so many troops and airplanes and, you know, go on an expedition to Antarctica. You wonder if they thought there was something there. Maybe they didn't find anything, but it was just a cover story for something they wanted to find out, because that was an unusual mission.
They couldn't get the troops. After the Second World War, they couldn't get the troops out fast enough. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of delays, and I think Admiral Byrd just sold them on an expedition. He said, I always wanted to have a big expedition to Antarctica, and we can go down there for about a year. And some of the people that came in at the end of the war, we can utilize them. And so to me, that's a possibility. It was a big deal to go around to all these islands and collect up all the people that were in the Pacific. They actually threw aircraft off carriers so they could carry personnel back to the U.S. So it was a big thing, you know. And if you read some of the American history, they're talking about people duration plus 6 months, but I've been here 8 months, and how come I can't get out? So they you know, it was like they had nothing for these guys to do, and we've got the resources, let's do this. That's just my opinion, and it doesn't hold any special water.
Before we wrap this up, I just want to mention that I'm going to put a link in my show notes to Jan's Project 1947 website, and there is also going to be a link in my show notes where you can donate to the National Historical UFO Records Center. So, Jan, thank you very much for being on the show again.
Okay, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Here are the Canadian civil aviation anomalies for the week of April 22nd through April 26th, 2024. On April 23rd, the LaRange, Saskatchewan Flight Service Station was advised of emergency remotely piloted aircraft system operations near an island approximately 4 nautical miles south of CYBC at 100 feet above ground level. Operations lasted from 0430 Zulu time to 0442 Zulu time. On April 19th, a weak intermittent emergency locator transmitter signal was heard at the tower from 0035 Zulu time to 0045 Zulu time. One aircraft on the ground and one aircraft 1 nautical mile south of the airport at 1,000 feet reported hearing a weak ELT signal. The shift manager was informed at 0049 Zulu time. On April 26th, there was an aviation incident reported at 0557 Zulu time to the Transportation Security Operations Center. The center was advised of a Sunwing Airlines Boeing 737 MAX 8 flying from Cayo Coco, Cuba, to Toronto Lester B. Pearson International Airport that was diverted to Orlando, Florida, after reporting a level 2 disturbance due to an unruly passenger. Law enforcement officers met the aircraft at the gate and removed the passenger. The flight continued to its destination after a 61-minute delay. There was an impact on one of the operations. All other flights proceeded to their destinations without further incident.
Well, that's our podcast for this week. Please share, follow, subscribe, and do all of those good things to help spread the word about UFO Talker. And until next time, this is Michael Ryan. Keep watching the skies.
You have been listening to the UFO Talker. If you have any questions or comments on this episode, you can email us at ufotalker@bell.net or visit our website at ufotalker.ca. You can support UFO Talker by using the Buy Me a Coffee app with links on our website and in the show notes. We appreciate every listener. Thank you for your support. This has been a Michael Ryan production.
30. That's a wrap.